Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we love to talk about teaching multilingual learners. I'm your host, Colette Ferron Goodwin, and I'm a resource specialist on the ENL team with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network at OCM BOCES in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Hello and welcome to another episode of Our Burning Questions. Our burning questions for today are, what is the importance of advocating for English language learners? And how can we create a shared sense of responsibility for supporting English language learners with regard to their academic and future professional success? And here to respond to these questions is a nationally known author, Diane Sterfenner, Dr. Diane Sterfenner. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Diane Sterfenner. Diane, welcome.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me here, Colette.
So before we get started responding to the Our Burning Questions, could you please just take a moment and share your title, your role, your position?
Sure. I am the president of Support Ed, and that is my title and role and position. So in this role, I created what's now known as Support Ed about 10 years ago, to be able to focus my efforts on supporting English learners and their families and their teachers and administrators.
Okay. Could you share with us your special areas of interest?
Sure, there are so many. Advocacy is first and foremost, so that's why I'm really excited that you have me here today to be talking about advocating for English learners and multilingual learners. Another area of interest really to me is assessment. A lot of equity issues around English learners and assessment. Also instruction. Recently, I've become more interested in social emotional learning for English learners and what that means. Another area of interest that I've been working on and learning more about is student mental health.
Okay, great. And so could you share with us a little bit about what drew you to working with ELLs to begin with?
Sure, there's so much that led me to this path. I always thought I was going to be a German professor, but then I ended up, after graduating from college, I was a first-generation college grad. I had a Fulbright scholarship to teach in the former East Berlin in Germany. And that's where I decided to shift my focus to teaching English. And then coming back to the U.S., I really got interested in teaching English to speakers of other languages, or ESOL, to English learners back in the U.S. In a couple of different contexts. In terms of, you know, how the advocacy fits in there, my first U.S.-based teaching assignment was as an ESL teacher in rural North Carolina. I had also, after doing my Fulbright scholarship in East Berlin, I also taught English in a bilingual school in Mexico, and really worked on developing my Spanish there, and was really very interested in working and teaching English there to primarily Mexican students. So when I was offered this position in North Carolina, they had just had a big influx of English learners there, a lot of migrant students, but then a good portion of students stayed as well. I really became interested in teaching them, but discovered that teaching ELs was so much more intertwined with advocacy, developing a program, helping shift people's mindsets from a deficit to an assets-based perspective, doing professional development, getting my administrator on board, and she really was on board to support English learners and their families. So really, you know, my experience abroad in Germany and in Mexico, and then my first year of teaching in a trailer in the U.S. and North Carolina really just cemented my desire to support English learners and their families.
Well, we are so thankful for all of the work that you've done so far and continue to do. Great. So on the topic of advocacy, why don't we start by just talking about the need for advocacy for ELLs. So would you tell us a little bit about the research base that supports the call to better advocate for our nation's English learners?
Sure, and the research base is always growing, right? So there are so many areas where we do have inequities in terms of English learners. And I do want to say, when I say English learners, that's the term that I'm using, but you know, also people use the term emergent bilinguals, multilingual learners. So you know, just trying to be more inclusive, but I'll probably primarily stick with English learners or ELLs during our time today. So some of the research base is, first and foremost, people really like to look at test scores. So focusing on how English learners do on content assessments, right? So they tend to score significantly lower, especially as they're, when they're at lower levels of proficiency, they tend to score lower on content assessments. Their graduation rates tend to be much lower than exited English learners or fully proficient students or students who have never received services, ESL services. So and that really varies by state as well. Some states really do a great job of it, whereas other states there are still huge gaps. Thinking right now during our pandemic, if we look at grading and how English learners have tended to do during the pandemic, they're tending to receive poorer grades by their teachers, and so not only on content tests, but poorer grades when compared to non-English learners or fully proficient students. Another area where that really underscores the urgency to advocate for ELLs is in the area of the under and over representation of ELLs in special education. It's really tricky to find that sweet spot where, for lack of a better term, where we can really use valid assessments and anecdotal data to determine if ELLs are eligible for special education or not. And along those lines, also the lack of English learner representation in gifted and talented programs. We've got a long ways to go in ensuring that ELLs are represented in GT programs, kind of congruently with their percentage of the population in school districts.
Thank you.
Sure.
So thank you for sharing, you know, that information on the data. I think that's really significant, and it's a, you know, it's a good point to start with. But let's kind of move into the advocacy piece. How would you define advocacy for English learners?
Yeah, there are so many ways to define it. And it's interesting also to look at the root of the word advocating. So it's from the Latin advocatus, which means one who is called to aid. And we also want to look at the cognates of advocacy. In Spanish, for example, it's abogado, which is a lawyer, an attorney. So it's interesting to look at how the word in general came to be. But I define it, and my definition is always evolving. So this is how I defined it in my book, which I know we're kind of drawing from today, advocating, I'll move my fingers, for English learners. So I defined it as working for ELLs, equitable and excellent education by taking appropriate actions on their behalf. So stepping in and providing a voice for those students and their families who have not yet developed their own strong voice in their education. Advocacy for ELLs also means knowing about each of my ELLs students and families' backgrounds to be able to know which appropriate action I need to take. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, but the goal is really for our students and their families to develop and really hone their own advocacy skills. So we're doing this in collaboration, and then we're kind of pulling back our advocacy and really scaffolding, well, you're going to ask me that in a second, I think, scaffolding our advocacy for ELLs and their families with the goal of them fully advocating for themselves on their own.
I mean, you mentioned the scaffolded advocacy. Go ahead and share with us what that means.
Yeah, so I was an ESOL teacher, and my role was scaffolding instruction. So providing, one of my many roles, right? So providing the just right amount of support that students need to be able to complete a task independently, to be able to complete a task with the goal of them completing the task independently. So I conceptualized scaffolded advocacy in a similar vein. So we want to, you know, help students, help their families, teach them, if they don't already know, some advocacy skills, and pull back our scaffolds of advocacy, just like we would in instruction, so they'll be able to advocate for themselves on their own and really effectively. And it recognizes that, you know, recognizing their strengths, that they do come with so many skills to be able to advocate for themselves. So sometimes it just requires a little support. Sometimes we don't need to advocate so much, depending on the students and the family situation.
Okay. And I think this is kind of intertwined in what you just shared, but what roles and voices must L educators leverage to support Ls?
Right, there's so many roles and voices that we need in the process, but and you know, the word you use, leverage, is really critical, because we need to find out what our own strengths are. So we need to kind of reflect and see what strengths we bring to the table. And there are so many roles and voices we can use to support Ls. ENL teachers, for example, in New York State, bring such specialized expertise in understanding language, many facets of language, understanding culture and culturally responsive teaching. And those, you know, that voice they can really leverage to support Ls. Content teachers, you know, are very well versed in their content, in their curriculum, so they can leverage that expertise, but it's always a collaborative effort that ENL or ESOL teachers should be collaborating with content teachers and administrators to advocate. And administrators might have more of a sense of, you know, what the policies are, what the constraints might be, what the budget might look like, to provide more of a context for the advocacy to take place.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And so, you know, you talked about, you know, the notion of scaffolded advocacy. And so can you tell us, why is that an important concept in the work that you do with Ls and their families? Why is that so important?
It's an important concept because, you know, when we're supporting Ls, oftentimes people really just want to have some strategies, you know, or some tools they can use to support Ls in instruction. But we really have to look at their education more holistically, that advocacy really is the undercurrent that runs through all of the work we do. And we can't just provide these great strategies, which might be great, but on their own, without this contextual piece, they won't be as effective. So, you know, we really have to look at all of the forces taking place right now in shaping Ls education. We have to look at aspects like what's happening in terms of immigration with refugee students and families coming or not coming to your area, for example. Really knowing the backgrounds of the students, not just the educational backgrounds, but, you know, like I mentioned, also the political backgrounds, knowing your school and district and state policies, how do they support or not our English learners? And so what teachers do is just so critical and often unrecognized in terms of what they're doing on a daily basis to advocate for English learners, especially during the pandemic. I've heard so many stories and witnessed so many amazing things teachers and administrators are doing to ensure that Ls can have as equitable of a chance and opportunity and experience in distance learning and hybrid learning, especially right now.
Great. So, you know, when we're thinking about, you know, that shared sense of responsibility for teaching English learners, can you discuss the importance of increasing understanding of the strengths and needs of Ls and their families?
Sure, it's really important to have a sense, and a realistic sense, to be able to share the responsibility. And I kind of go beyond sharing just responsibility, but I also want to emphasize sharing the joy, not just the responsibility, but the joy that comes with experiencing all the Ls and their families have to offer. But you can't always get to the joy without having a clear sense of tools and strategies and collaboration and feeling supported in your work to be able to advocate. So it's, you know, it's just very important that everyone see themselves as a teacher of English learners, as a teacher of not only content but academic language. So this is from your kindergarten teacher to your physics teacher. Need to really understand that they're not only teaching their content, they're also have you know, the responsibility of teaching academic language as well, and teaching in a culturally responsive manner. So it's you know, when a lot of people got their certification to become teachers, they might not have had as strong of a sense of the calling to truly educate elves holistically and to share the responsibility and the joy in doing such.
Okay. So some of our listeners may be thinking to themselves right now, how do I get this process started? You know, I have a certain direction that I want to head in terms of developing greater empathy for elves and their families. What are some steps that you might recommend to take in individual contexts to support colleagues in developing this greater empathy?
Sure. There are so many areas that we can focus on in terms of supporting elves and advocating for elves. So I would encourage colleagues to brainstorm a list of issues you might want to look at, but then to prioritize the issues and to ask yourself these two questions. And these come from my colleague, Paul Gorski. And he says to first think of what's an area in which you can make a change and what's an area in which you cannot make a change. And so we really have to look at, you know, and focus on the area that you do have a chance of making a change and where you do have some agency. So really focusing on, you know, what's realistic? What could you really accomplish? And kind of, you know, zoning in on that area. And to be able to advocate, we've worked with the National Education Agency, the NEA, or Association, I'm sorry, the NEA, to be able to develop a five-step process for advocating for elves. And the first is to choose your issue. You know, you really need to, you can't do it all at once, and you have to focus on what you're willing to talk about. And then you want to look at your, develop and identify your allies. So who are the people, who are your colleagues that are most likely going to be willing and able and excited about advocating with you? And then you want to, the third step is to know the rights of English learners. So you want to know the relevant laws and the policies and also the research that undergirds what you wish to do. So it's not just you having a good idea and wanting to advocate. It's knowing what's your support. So what's the research say? What are the laws that are on your side? What are the policies in your district or state that are guiding what you can do? And then you want to develop your outlets for outreach. So are you going to focus at the classroom level, the grade level, the school level, maybe the district level? And then you want to expand your outreach and really communicate your message to others. So is there a news outlet or a school newspaper that you might want to get involved? So these are some ways to really be practical and have a plan for advocating.
What's the importance of reflecting on the level of shared sense of responsibility?
Yeah, there's so much, you know, we do so much in a day, and we often don't think about what we're, everything that we have going on. But the reflection piece is really critical to have a better chance at really being able to, you know, make a change, a positive change for elves. And so we want to reflect on all of the issues taking place. So we usually don't get time to do this, but I really would recommend it, to the degree possible, hitting the pause button, blocking some time, you know, turning off your cell phone, shutting down the computer, getting to write out the areas where you want to look at. And, you know, this is a great time of year as the school year comes to an end, to think about what have you accomplished and what do you maybe want to focus on next year.
So when, you know, when we talk, you mentioned a lot about collaboration. So I want to just talk about how teachers can collaborate to expand the advocacy efforts for elves. So what are the potential opportunities for collaboration and advocacy, and how does this relate to the advocacy ripple effect?
Yeah, so I'll start first by the advocacy ripple effect. So it's just a way to look at your sphere of influence in a way, and how many, what your impact, what your level of impact can be. So are you, you know, the kind of center point of the ripple is your classroom. If you're in a classroom, you know, what are your parameters for advocating? And then beyond your classroom, you can advocate at the grade level, or you're in within a content area. Let's say, you know, you're an ENL teacher who primarily provides support during English language arts. So maybe you can advocate to a wider audience there. And then after that, you can advocate at the school level, which is getting bigger, or at the district level, at the state level, at the national level. But I really think that the classroom level can be one of the most powerful places to advocate. Just think of, you know, all of your students, the number that you serve, and what you can do there. So there are many opportunities for collaboration and advocacy at that classroom level. So you're collaborating most likely if you're an ENL teacher with a content teacher. If you're a content or grade level teacher, you're hopefully collaborating with an ENL teacher, maybe a special education teacher. You're probably collaborating with the school, with the librarian, with the guidance counselors. There's so many staff that you're probably collaborating with. So I, you know, recommend again, jotting down, who do you collaborate with on a daily basis or a weekly basis? So there are, you know, so many opportunities there. And of course, you're collaborating with your administrator. And if you're an administrator, you're collaborating with a wide variety of educators. So, you know, first it's just getting a sense of the scope of your collaboration, first of all.
Great. So are there necessary skills that are needed to address each ripple?
Certainly there would be some kind of cross-cutting skills, and I'm going to talk about them more in depth when we do our next podcast on leadership. I think first of all is looking at interpersonal skills. So sometimes these are called soft skills. These are usually, again, not taught when you're getting certified to become a teacher, but I think they should be, especially, you know, as teachers, we're all called to be leaders. And again, I'm going to be going in more depth about that at my next podcast session with you. But some of the skills, you know, are, first of all, knowing your content and having these interpersonal skills like conflict resolution, because when you're advocating, you're going to come up against conflict. You're going to have pushback. So what do you do to address that pushback, for example? So those are, you know, some critical skills. Having cultural awareness, being able to communicate effectively. These are all types of skills that are really going to help educators in, you know, trying to expand the ripple of their advocacy if they wish to do so. And if they wish to keep their advocacy at the classroom level, well, there, that's an awesome opportunity as well.
Great. So you do have a chapter in the book that discusses advocacy for school and district administrators. However, I know, you know, we're kind of focusing on teachers during this episode. We've got a whole separate episode devoted to leaders. So what advice would you give to ENL teachers who might have to approach their administrators in order to advocate for their ELs?
Sure, and I would go back to the five-step process that I, you know, I just mentioned earlier. But the first is to be able to really define your issue. You know, what's the issue that you want to focus on, and have one issue at a time. Not, you know, I want to talk about these five things with you. I would also, you know, set a time to meet with an administrator. Give them a heads up in writing, you know, this is what I'd like to talk about. And that kind of helps them prepare, helps the administrator prepare for what's coming. Having been at the district level in Fairfax County Public Schools, I was the ESOL assessment specialist for the county. And so just knowing kind of what my meetings might have looked like, you know, knowing what the issue is, makes me feel as an administrator a little more welcoming, a little potentially less defensive. So it gives me a chance to do my homework as well. So we're kind of both coming from this informed space. Also, an ENL teacher could draw from any research or policy and really have a goal in mind. You know, this is what I would like to see happen. And this is why. Here's the research, here's the data. Also looking at English learner data to back up whatever you would like to advocate for. For example, if you want to advocate to include more you know, look at more L's being included, for example, in gifted and talented programs, first come with the data, right? So how many, what percentage of L's do you have in your school? And what percent are found, are taking part in gifted and talented programs? So really showing numbers and being able to tell number stories of your data to really help it make sense. Many times administrators don't have any kind, you know, too much coursework in English learners. So you're the one as an ENL teacher who really understands what your, you know, what are the gist of our population, right? How multifaceted they are, all of the strengths and needs that they come with. So being able to have those conversations and also to practice an elevator speech. So have a 30-second little snippet, a soundbite of what you'd like to advocate for, what your issue is, and really make it understandable and accessible. Try it on a friend who's not a teacher. See if they understand what you're really talking about. Not using jargon, for example. These are all things that will help you approach your administrator. And then at the end of your conversation, you know, what are your next steps going to be? What will you do to further the conversation? And are you going to get together again in a couple of weeks to talk about the issue again? Because as we know, administrators are really busy. So what will the follow-up be? And how will you know if you're successful? So be thinking of these items.
Right. Yeah, I like the you know, that your concept of the number stories and the elevator speech. They're, you know, clear and concise messages, and you know, you really can you know, get your point across directly, right?
Right, absolutely.
So I'd like to turn the focus now on family involvement, because we know that, you know, with English language learners, we know that a lot of times, you know, the parents don't always know that they should advocate. So can you talk about the importance of L parent and family involvement and share some strategies to increase L family involvement in their children's education?
Sure. And, you know, and looking in terms of, you know, what L families are doing, we're also using, you know, starting to shift our language and going from involvement to engagement. Just with the different meaning of engagement, kind of showing more of a two-way street, that it's not just the families that should be involved, it's the families and the educators that should be engaged with one another. So, you know, in looking at the importance of L family engagement, and, you know, I notice that you do say family, and I'm kind of picking apart all of this language, which is great. So we really want to focus on the family. It's not always biological parents, right? A lot of times our students might be living with an aunt or an uncle, or, you know, a foster parent, or they might be, you know, in some kind of temporary housing. So, and also the siblings might be super engaged. Oh, many times we know that our older siblings and even the little ones translate and they interpret on the spot for the older family members that are developing their English skills. So, you know, this concept of family can really mean a multi-generational household. We have also a lot of older L's, you know, who are living maybe on their own and supporting themselves. So the term family really spans so many individuals. So in terms of the importance and strategies, we want to first recognize that our families are often super engaged, but sometimes in ways that are invisible, that we don't always see. For example, during distance learning times, we don't see what's happening in the background, right? Like, we haven't seen how a family might set aside a quieter place in the home and ensure that their child is logging on, that they're making that child a snack, as I'm doing for my kids right now today, while the student's on their computer. We don't see how the family is ensuring that the technology is working, or reaching out to the school when it's not, or texting a friend like, hey, what are you doing to log on, or how do we complete this assignment? We don't see those conversations or hear them when the family is saying how important it is to get an education, because That's why I risked so much to come to this country, so you could do better than I am. We don't see those conversations, and we don't hear them. And oftentimes, educators come from that place of deficit, not knowing, and making these assumptions about what's happening or not happening at the home. So the pandemic and online schooling has really taught us, and I've heard educator Larry Filazzo say this repeatedly, so we have to approach it from a place of grace. We have to make the assumptions that, you know, of the assets and that all that the parents and the families are doing to support their kids. We have to assume the best, which is really what I've seen as an educator, you know, in working with ELLs and ELL families. And this is definitely an area of passion for mine, specifically in supporting English learners. Coming out to their homes, doing, you know, doing home visits, being, but in a culturally responsive way. My colleague, Dr. Ayanna Cooper, says, really be careful about the home visits. Don't overstep. See if the parents want to, you know, to have you come in. You know, many times they'll welcome you with open arms, but other times it might not feel right. So we really have to know our students and know their families well. Another way to really get to know the community piece, so it's not just families in schools, it's also bringing in the community, is doing community walks. In our latest book, Culturally Responsive Teaching for Multilingual Learners, we draw from, her name is Lauren Markham, and she is an administrator, a counselor in Oakland, at the Oakland International High School in California. And she's developed a great protocol for doing community walks. So having students develop a great professional development session for teachers about their communities. So what do they want teachers to know? And then the teachers and the students work to actually go out into the communities. What will you visit? Will it be a place of worship? Will it be a restaurant? Will you go visit a store? And you have these deep conversations that are completely student-driven and very powerful about the strengths and the, you know, the wonderful attributes that are present within communities. So that those are a couple of ways to really increase engagement. Another way is to not have the families come into the school, to develop the trust first, and that's so key, by meeting the families where they are, literally and figuratively. So is there a community center, a place of worship, where a school can come, a school can go out to have a parent meeting, for example, about you know, a student's progress, not expecting the parents and the families to come in to, you know, parent night. Also to find out what's the best time and place for the parents to meet, asking them. We often don't even ask these questions. We make assumptions. Many times, you know, in my kids' schools, there'll be a parent-teacher association meeting, you know, at like 10 o'clock on a Tuesday. Well, a lot of parents might be working then. Mm-hmm. So finding out what would work for them, for example. So first, you know, building that trust, and from that trust, going from there. Once they're comfortable with you going to them, well, maybe can they come to us? But really stressing, there'll be an interpreter, there'll be food, there'll be childcare, we'll help with transportation. We want to look at these barriers to family engagement and really provide solutions to each of these barriers. Again, assuming that the parents and the families want to be there, but we have to take a couple of extra steps for that to happen. That will pay off greatly in the future.
Okay. So I think you've kind of touched on these indirectly in responding to this first question, but what are some typical challenges in your experience that ELL families face in terms of school involvement, and how can these challenges be addressed by a district?
Right. So there are quite a few. And, you know, I'll just name like a few, but you might have others in mind. I'm sure the listeners will have others in mind as well. So a couple would be transportation, childcare. I'll start with transportation and childcare. So I think of, you know, one of my first experiences as an advocate when I didn't even know what it was called. It was just called supporting families, I guess. I didn't call myself an advocate. It wasn't a term at the time, really, that I was aware of. So we held a parent night, or family night, I should say, just for English learner families at the school, where they could meet with the teachers. We cooked a huge meal. I had a wonderful paraprofessional who I worked with, and we called each of the families individually and spoke with them in the home language. In the case, our case was Spanish, inviting them in personally. So not just, you know, not just writing, sending home an invitation in writing that someone might throw out, but, and worst of all, only in English, but making that personal phone call and inviting them, and offering transportation. So we had parents carpool with each other. We offered to go, you know, pick up families if they needed a ride. You'd obviously have to work with your district and find out what are the parameters of doing such, you know, what are the legal constraints if there are. But some other districts provide funds for transportation. They would provide taxi vouchers, for example, or, you know, if you have a bus, you know, bus tokens, or just a way to really bring families in. And I also do want to state that it's a Title III requirement that you meet with parents and that you provide materials in the home language and you provide interpreters. So they're included to the same degree that native English speakers are. So that's, you know, one area of a challenge. In terms of childcare, so oftentimes parents are very unlikely to come in because they have other younger children at home. So providing childcare at any kind of school-based events is critical. You might have, older teenagers that need some community service hours that they could get this way through providing childcare. You might have college-age students that are getting a degree in early childhood education that could use this, you know, provided the childcare services as part of their course requirements, for example. So it's really about being creative and flexible and collaborating to see, you know, what you could do and what you might be able to offer. So that's a couple of examples of barriers and solutions.
Okay, thank you. And I know that you do have a tool on your website as well. So and later at the end we'll provide a resource that our listeners can actually access those resources. So turning our focus now to the instruction of ELLs. So, you know, we've talked about families, we've talked about teachers. Let's focus on the actual instruction of English learners. How is advocacy leveraged through effective instruction?
Sure. Effective instruction is really another tool for advocacy and vice versa. And so we really have to understand, you know, language acquisition. Not to a huge degree, you know, I don't think that, you know, your seventh grade math teacher needs to have a degree in linguistics per se, but content teachers do have to understand that it's a process. It's not always linear, and what it might look like and what we might expect from students at different levels of English language proficiency. So, effective instruction, we have to look at how we scaffold instruction and how we bed the instruction of academic language into the instruction of content to better serve English learners, but also other students who might need some extra support in acquiring language and content simultaneously. So we know that all students really need academic language to be able to acquire challenging content and to engage with challenging content and to be successful in school and beyond. So advocating, you know, through effective instruction is just so important to give our students, all of our students, the best opportunities they have to be able to be successful in the classroom. And like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, it's not just about providing, you know, a couple of great scaffolds or strategies for students that are going to get them to where they need to be. You have to demonstrate that you're there for them. You understand. You know their home. You know what their home language is. You know what culture they might identify themselves as, or which culture is plural, to be able to advocate and to provide this scaffolded instruction for students.
What would some of the considerations be for planning effective instruction for ELLs while incorporating advocacy?
Sure, there are so many things to keep in mind. First and foremost, you know, you would need to know what their level of English language proficiency is in the four areas, and you know, the four modalities: reading, writing, speaking, and listening. You'd want to know a little bit about their home literacy skills. One thing that we used to do in Fairfax County Schools in Virginia, where I worked for a good number of years, is that when students would register for the district, we would get a home language writing sample. It was nothing, you know, and not an off-the-shelf test. We would just give them a few images to choose from, give them some writing prompts in their home language, and have them write for us. And you could tell, even if you didn't speak that language, the length that they wrote, how difficult was it for them to produce this writing sample. You can see, you know, are they including punctuation, for example? Are they writing on the lines? You know, how is it looking, for example? And a bonus, if you did speak the language, then you could just kind of take a quick check, a snapshot of where they are, depending. And also, you'd want to look at their level of schooling in the home language, if they've received any. Have there been gaps in education? Those types of things. And also, what are their interests? What motivates them? So these are some elements to look at when you're lesson planning. And then, of course, you want to look at your content objectives, also language objectives. That's still a tricky area for a lot of educators, is to develop language objectives that support content objectives. And also, I would, you know, suggest doing this collaboratively. So you would have an ENL or ESOL teacher collaborating with a content teacher or a group of teachers to develop lessons. I've seen it in some schools where administrators are very purposeful about this, and they have their own templates to encourage this type of cross-content collaboration to really leverage everyone's expertise.
Great. So let's shift now from lesson planning to assessment. In your experience working with districts, what trends or potential advocacy issues have you identified with regard to assessment at the teacher, building, and district level?
Sure. You know, there are so many issues and so many trends. I do want to say I feel like people are more aware now in terms of validity in assessment of ELLs. So, you know, validity is the degree to which we're assessing the construct that we say we're assessing. So, for example, if you're having students, you know, answer an open-ended question on, you know, the causes of the Civil War, you want to see that what you're assessing is, you know, are they articulating the causes of the Civil War? Not necessarily are they using, you know, verb tenses that you're expecting, or are they, you know, have they not fully developed a perfect response, quote-unquote perfect? Are you looking at the grammar, or are you looking at the content? Similarly, if you're assessing, you know, their thinking, you want them to explain their thinking and looking at a word problem, providing an answer to a word problem in math. Are you looking at the mathematical portion or the linguistic portion? So we really want to focus on the validity, really giving ELLs the best chance to showcase what they know and what they can do. So, you know, we want to focus on removing some of those linguistic barriers that we can, that might get in the way of the content. So do we really have to use all of the extraneous language in formulating a word problem, for example? So that's what I would look at. Also, you know, trends in terms of advocacy and assessment, there's been a lot of focus lately on grading. So, you know, we want to look at, are we grading ELLs equitably? And that's been an area that we originally worked on for OCM BOCES and for the Mid-State Arbor, looking at grading. And we came up with our own framework, and we called it the five pillars for equitably grading English learners. And so that's also an area, especially as I mentioned earlier, in pandemic times when students are working remotely, how has, what does English learner grading look like during these times? Are teachers giving students a little bit of leeway, some leeway on deadlines, giving them more support as needed to really enable ELMs to show more what they know and can do?
I think sometimes teachers they're a little hesitant to make those kinds of adjustments because they don't think they can. So sometimes it's important to convey that message sometimes and get that message across.
Right, absolutely. And that's a huge area for advocacy too. Are there other teachers that feel the same way? And what could you do to approach an administrator on that topic? Yeah, that would be very powerful. Yeah, and often there is some leeway that we're just not aware of because we don't ask.
Right.
So it is scary, right?
Yeah.
So can be.
Yeah, absolutely. So what steps could you recommend that could be taken to identify the most significant advocacy issues for ELLs in terms of assessment?
One of the first steps would be to ask the students themselves. Many times we don't go directly to the source and we make assumptions. So I think the first, most important step, especially for older students, is to ask them themselves, where do you feel there's not equity or fairness in assessment? Go from there. Ask the, the parents or the families as well. Talk to other teachers that might serve ELLs in your context and ask them what they're thinking too. So that's, again, a lot about is prioritizing and looking at what could you change, what could you maybe not change. This wasn't directly what you asked, but I would also look at scaffolding assessments. So not only instruction, but sometimes we don't follow through and actually scaffold the assessments. So, depending on the level of proficiency or the task, could you provide a word bank for students? And that might help some of your native English speakers too, but not help in a way that will invalidate the assessment, especially in working remotely. You're so removed from, the physical context. A teacher can't see if you're struggling while you're taking an assessment, for example. So I would definitely recommend scaffolding assessments and not only instruction. And also,
No, it's okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and also I would suggest collaborating around developing assessments. Not only collaborating to plan instruction, but to also plan assessment. So we get the most from the cycle to inform instruction, which is the whole purpose of formative assessment, right? To look at the evidence you collect, the data you collect, and then what are you going to do with it? How are you going to use it to improve instruction and to further support your students who need more support in particular areas?
Yeah, I was just gonna make a connection and just say that, sometimes teachers have a little bit of resistance in scaffolding those assessments because of state testing requirements, right? Because you can't provide those scaffolds on state tests, and so why provide them on the tests in the classroom, the formative assessments. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we do, again, the goal of scaffolding, whether it be advocacy or instruction or assessments, is for students to be able to do it on their own. So, giving them the opportunity to complete formative assessments that are scaffolded, but also preparing them for state or content tests where they don't get the particular scaffolds.
Right.
Showing them both versions, making sure they're aware and are of what's going to be expected and are used to both of those kinds of formats would be critical.
In looking at the systemic aspects of school districts, what role has the most impact in selecting, improving, and implementing accommodations for ELLs on content assessments?
Sure, and we can look at, how are accommodations or supports chosen? And I do want to give a shout out to Dr. Lynn Schaefer-Wilner. She's done just a tremendous amount of work in this area. So in terms of selecting and implementing accommodations or systemic supports for English learners. It really should be a collaborative process where you have an ENL teacher or an ESOL teacher collaborating with the content teacher and, to the degree possible, administrator on a case-by-case basis, and looking at which students could benefit the most from which types of supports on content assessments. And, of course, knowing what's allowed in your particular context, right? It varies by state. Sometimes it varies by proficiency level of students. So, you know, being very intentional about how you approach this work. And then also ensuring that, to the degree possible, these types of supports are used in classroom instruction and assessment, because we don't want students encountering them for the first time on a high-stakes assessment, a high-stakes content assessment. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if they're allowed a bilingual glossary on a content assessment, making sure they're using a bilingual glossary throughout the school year in their class, so they're used to this type of support.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So what are the implications that might arise when there are breakdowns in the system, either at the teacher, building, or district level?
Right, so implications in terms of ELSIN assessments when there are breakdowns. Yeah, the biggest implication is that an individual student won't have access to what they need. So for example, there are many things that they could be needing, or that there will be inequities, such as, you know, a student won't get, we call it in Virginia, a verified credit, that they might not pass a content assessment to be able to get a credit that applies toward graduation at whatever kind of diploma they're going for. So that would be a huge worst case scenario. There are also many areas in terms of assessment. You know, they could be identified for example, for special education, or not identified for special education services, depending on assessment results. You know, if we look at the prevalence of having bilingual school psychologists, we barely have any, right? And that's mm-hmm. an area where we really need more trained individuals and bilingual individuals going into those fields. Other areas, our English learners might not have access to courses like advanced placement courses or international baccalaureate courses in high school, because, you know, they didn't do well on a classroom assessment or a content assessment. So there are just huge implications, which is why we really need that level of awareness and advocacy in terms of assessment, to give our ELs just as much of a chance as they can have to show what they know and can do, and have access to programs and to graduation, to looking beyond high school as well.
Yeah, well, and that's a nice transition to my next topic. I wanted to talk about advocacy for ELS success beyond graduation. So could you tell us what the correlation is between advocacy, graduation dropout rates, and ELS success beyond grade 12?
Sure. I don't have any research, but I have lots of anecdotal evidence and just, you know, how much advocacy can impact what's going to happen to our students. So I think of, you know, just a very informal program that we had in the high school where I was an ESOL teacher, where we would meet once a year at the end of the year with the ESOL team and the guidance counselors at our high school, and then meet with our feeder schools from elementary. From middle school. So looking at a case-by-case basis of each student coming up to high school, just talking about these students holistically. You know, where were they? What were their strengths? Where were they struggling? Where were they going to be placed in the high school? Making sure that we looked at each student's schedules and coursework so they were on this path to graduation. Because a lot of times your guidance counselors might not have training and working with English learners, you know, ENL courses, credits, and how all of that is awarded can be tricky. You might have a lot of teacher or guidance turnover in a particular year. So making sure, we really wanted to make sure that no student fell through the cracks and that they were going to be on a trajectory to graduate and to also, if they were interested in, you know, looking into college, which we would always suggest, looking at an advanced diploma, making sure they have the coursework for that. Making sure in my district, for example, and in many districts, you can take an assessment to award students with a couple of world language credits, right? So if you have a native Farsi speaker, maybe you have a Farsi assessment that if they passed it, they would get a couple of those credits to count towards their diploma in another world language, for example. So, you know, that was just some anecdotal evidence about getting students on a path to graduation and meeting with them to really showcase what progress they were making. Many students weren't really aware of their proficiency levels and what that means, and are they making progress? And at what level do they need to be able to exit out of ESOL services, for example? So making sure students were aware of, you know, the meaning behind their scores or what they had to do to move up a level, for example, in writing or in reading. So it's really important to have those conversations with students. Also knowing what are, you know, kind of what are some of the options and after graduation, and having those conversations with students and families starting in elementary, not waiting to high school, being open and, you know, bringing in colleges or, you know, career vocational programs. To have information sessions specifically targeted for L parents in with interpreters is really critical as well. Knowing what options are available to them, bringing in L's themselves, former students who have graduated and who have been successful, bringing in these kinds of role models so students, current L students, can identify with them, seeing themselves represented in students who have gone on to different fields is really powerful and such a motivator as well. To have these kind of formal and informal mentors, especially if the parents maybe did not complete their studies, you know, at the middle or high school or college levels. So, you know, just providing all these different types of support is really crucial for students.
So in terms of, you know, providing the support for students and for their success beyond grade 12, how have you seen this be reflected in current trends of L's participating in programs such as advanced coursework, CTE programs, gifted talented program, training, and other options?
Yeah, it's great that you asked that question. We're definitely getting more awareness now of L's participating in advanced placement, career and technical education, and gifted and talented, but we still have a long ways to go. So we've got a lot of inequities still out there to advocate for, but it's a good sign that we're now having more of these conversations. Excuse me, and you know, looking, for example, in CTE programs, my group Support Ed has been doing some work on scaffolding curriculum and content to be more inclusive of L's in CTE. And I'm a huge proponent of CTE programs. Not every student wants to go to college, for example, or wants to attend, you know, a 2-year more of a vocational training, maybe get an associate's degree. And I think that's wonderful. I think we should look to other countries, for example, like Germany, that has apprenticeship programs where students can get specialized training, work in their field, actually get paid for doing it, and develop skills that are really needed in society. We need electricians, we need plumbers, we need people who really understand car mechanics, especially as our cars move toward more electric, computer-based models. And society, I think, needs to place more of a value on these fields as well. So it's great that we're having more conversations about L's participating in these types of programs and coursework. And I would suggest that you really take a look in your own district and your schools to see what's your data, what are your data tell you in terms of L participation, not only participation, but success. if you have ELLs participating, for example, in advanced placement programs, how well are they doing on the AP tests at the end compared to native English speakers? Mm. What kind of supports are they getting? Is there any kind of threshold of English language proficiency that they need, you know, according to your district policy, to be able to take these courses? So there are many areas in which we can definitely continue to advocate.
Okay, great. So in moving forward, in what ways can institutes of higher education and districts strengthen their relationship to ensure equitable pathways to professional academic success?
Sure, there's so many ways. And I think it goes back to collaboration and awareness. Something that we would do in Fairfax County schools is we would meet with the local institutes of higher education that were certifying our teachers. So providing certified ENL teachers or content teachers to really have a reality check of, hey, this is what we're facing now in the public schools, and ensuring that the coursework that the students were getting at the university was in line and aligned with what the expectations were and the demands were on students and on teachers. Sometimes it can take a university some time to catch up with the reality that's happening in the local school district. So having these conversations was really crucial and really eye-opening to the universities. Mm-hmm. So they're just really relevant conversations to be having. And to make sure that, you know, we have that pipeline going, that we have open lines of communication to provide the most highly skilled candidates to the school districts.
All right, great. Thank you. I know that you have a couple of resources available on this topic. Would you like to share those? And I will be sure to add them to the website as well.
Oh, sure. So, the book I shared, Advocating mm-hmm. for English Learners. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of resources I've also developed on advocacy for the Colorín Colorado website. Mm-hmm. We have some Padlets as well mm-hmm. on advocacy and blog posts. So hopefully you can include those.
Yes, absolutely. As well as the Support Ed website. We will also include that as well.
That itself. Yeah,
all right.
Great.
All right. Wonderful. Well, Diane, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it. And we look forward to our upcoming episodes that we're going to be talking about more topics. So thank
you
so much.
Thanks so much, Colette.
Yeah,
thank
you.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guest we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please visit the Mid-State Auburn webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Catalyst from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.